Counsel, may it please the court. Okay. Are the microphones working okay?
I think so.
Okay, great. So there are two issues that are on appeal here about the trial that happened in the Winkler v. Schaefer matter. As the court knows, this was a pileup on the highway. The tractor trailer driven by Mr. Schaefer jackknifed across the road, blocking the highway, and then multiple vehicles kind of plowed into it, including the Winklers. And the Winklers were seriously injured. When it came to trial, we had done expert disclosures and everything in accordance with the rules, and defendant actually had got an extension to do their expert disclosures. So they had even more time than normal. They filed their expert disclosures regarding Sergeant Gates. So we thought we knew what his opinions were going to be. He was disclosed as a non-retained expert, in addition to a fact witness, because he was actually there at the scene that day. And then his trial preservation deposition was held and was videotaped 10 days before the trial, because the trooper, he's from Wyoming, so it would have been difficult to subpoena him, and he was going to be on vacation. So as a matter of courtesy, both sides agreed to do a trial preservation video. We did that, and during that deposition that was in preparation for trial, defense counsel solicited opinions from Sergeant Gates, which were never disclosed anywhere, and very damaging ones to the plaintiff's case, including that nobody was driving unreasonably, that nobody was driving too fast for conditions, that nobody was negligent in this case, and in fact, the weather was the cause of the accident. Now, this is the first time that he had ever said that, either in private conversations or in his disclosed statements. So we moved the court to strike just those opinions, just those ones that were not disclosed, prior to playing his videotaped deposition at trial. And the trial court denied that request. And the only reasoning given was that since we agreed to let do a trial preservation video, we had somehow waived the right to object to the opinions that might be expressed during that testimony.
That's Mr. Murphy, let me interrupt you.
Please.
I want to understand the basis of your arguments. Are you arguing that the trial court erred because it allowed the deposition to be taken after the deadline for expert disclosures?
No, not at all. In fact, normally the discovery deadline is after expert disclosures. You're meant to depose people afterwards. However, that doesn't give free rein for anyone to offer new opinions during that deposition testimony. Deposition is meant to normally to flush out the opinions, find out the basis for them, but not to offer new opinions that were not disclosed when they're required to be by Rule 26. So our objection is that the trial court allowed the undisclosed testimony to be presented to the jury.
So you're arguing that the trial court erred in allowing the deposition because some of the statements in the deposition exceeded the scope of the expert disclosure?
I'm sorry, no, Your Honor. Actually, allowing the deposition was okay, and in fact, we agreed to allow the deposition to occur. Allowing the deposition into testimony in part was fine, but under Rule 32B, objections to the admissibility of any evidence in that deposition don't have to be raised until trial, and that's what we did. It's the admissibility of certain testimony that came out in that deposition that should not have been allowed to be played for the jury. And had he testified live, we would have objected when the questions were answered at trial, and the judge would have ruled on them then. It's a similar situation here.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, but so you have this deposition, and you know before you walk into court what the officer is going to be saying because the officer is testifying via the deposition. Now, understanding this may not be ideal, but it's not like this was sprung on you at trial. I mean, you have some time to think about this, right?
Had some time to think about it, but not much. It was 10 days.
I understood, but yeah. You at least had 10 days to think about what the officer had to say.
Yes, but there wasn't any time to do anything about that. So I couldn't call the officer to the stand and cross-examine him further about that testimony after having those 10 days to prepare. I couldn't disclose a new expert who had reviewed the testimony and offered new opinions at trial, and that's what would have needed to happen. So
did you ask the trial court to do any of those things?
No, I asked the trial court to strike the testimony in a written motion prior to trial happening, and said that there wasn't time to do either of those two things. First, we had already established that the officer wasn't subject to subpoena nor available to testify, so I couldn't have really dragged him in order to re-cross-examine him. And 10 days simply was not enough time to get a retained expert witness to review that testimony. And we didn't get the transcript right away. There was a little bit of delay there before we got the official transcript, and review that and then disclose what new testimony that might be. So there just was not time to adequately address those opinions, even though we knew it 10 days before trial.
Did you request a continuance?
I did not request a continuance. I should say this, the motion wasn't actually ruled upon until trial itself. So we were already there. And no, we didn't ask for a continuance. We just asked for this to be stricken. The court did not consider any other remedies that might be appropriate, whether it's continuing the trial or damages wouldn't have helped in this case, but the court offered no such alternative remedies. We were very clear that the only thing we believed that could remedy this at the time was to strike the testimony.
Did you make an offer of proof of what you would have done or shown had you received adequate notice?
I did not make an offer of proof as to what we would have shown because we did not have the expert in order to review it. That was part of the problem. I did say we would have had an expert, time to have an expert review it and to meet this testimony, I believe.
And you had an expert lined up, Mr. Railsback.
And he did testify.
Did you go over that testimony with Mr. Railsback before he testified? Did you provide him with a copy of the transcript?
No, Your Honor, said there wasn't time between his schedule and the date of the trial in order to have all of that reviewed and offer new opinions. So, no, I did not.
Let me ask you one more question.
Absolutely.
On this issue before you move on.
Yeah.
Assuming you were going to move on to the next issue. In your briefs, you quoted 4 or 5 pages of testimony from the transcript of Sergeant Gates' testimony and argued that this was beyond the scope of the expert disclosure. But there was no argument that I could see about specifically what in that testimony was beyond the scope of expert disclosure. And I'm wondering, are you relying on us to just find that within all that testimony? Why didn't you point out what you thought was beyond the scope of the disclosure?
So what I did, Your Honor, instead was, and I apologize if it wasn't the clearest way to present this, in the reply brief on page 10, I quoted what Dr. Schaefer's actual disclosure was, and I'm Dr. Schaefer, I keep saying that. It was Sergeant Gates' testimony, so what the disclosure actually said he was going to say, his observations, his investigation. There's a vehicle that immediately was in front of the car that slowed down. And then each of the questions outlined that are quoted verbatim in the brief were questions about opinions outside the scope of this, each and every one of them. And that's why those sections were reprinted for the court, just so you didn't have to go searching for them. But every one of those questions asked for is an opinion that was well outside of this. And I'm sorry, I thought that was clear from the brief, but you don't have to go beyond the language in the briefs themselves in order to compare those two things.
In your opening brief at pages 30 and 31, you refer to Sergeant Gates' opinions that the weather was the true cause of the collision and that none of the defendants were driving inappropriately, driving at an unreasonable or high rate of speed, traveling too close for conditions, or the cause of the collisions. And those are the opinions that you contend are exceed the scope of his original disclosures?
Yes, exactly. And then his specific testimony states those things. So those were the big problems. And those go to the heart of the case. I mean, this was not a small matter. This was, you know, somebody who, with respected credentials, who had been trained in, you know, accident investigation, who was at the scene of the accident, who witnessed those things. And there's reason to believe those opinions weren't valid, but I couldn't get into that in the time that was there. He testified, for example, that he thought Mr. Schaefer was going 20 to 30 miles an hour, and our expert testified that based on the standards applicable to a tractor trailer driver in icy conditions, that they should be going at a crawl, maybe less than 10 miles an hour. So there were definitely areas on which he could have been cross-examined had we known he was going to be saying those things, and we could have had an expert specifically address that testimony had we known it was coming. But it was not provided in time under Rule 26, and under Rule 37, the standard is very clear that the defendant would have had to show that the failure to disclose was substantially justified or harmless, and neither is the case here.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Murphy,
okay,
but understanding that the line between expert and lay opinion is sometimes fuzzy, this is an officer who testified about what he saw with his own eyes at the time, as opposed to an officer who would talk about doing an accident reconstruction based upon examining the vehicle, applying mathematical models, and those sorts of things. Was the officer really testifying any differently than a layperson who happened to be standing by the side of the road and who was there would have testified?
Absolutely. First, the officer and we didn't object to any of the fact testimony of the officer. He said he saw this vehicle did that, this vehicle didn't do that. Those were all fine. But those are clear opinions when he talked about whether something was too fast as opposed to what the speed might have been.
But couldn't those have been lay opinions? People can say, looks like he's driving too fast on the icy road to me, can't they?
Actually, I think you would have to establish that they would have some basis for saying that it was too fast for the icy road, at least that they had driven before or something. It's beyond the scope of somebody who has never driven, for sure. So I think there's some expertise required, but defendant here specifically qualified this witness as an expert and talked about his time on the force, that he had been promoted, that he was a sergeant, that he'd been doing this a long time, that he is trained in accident investigation, and then he was trained in how to interpret what people were doing on the roadway. So it's not the same strength as if some layperson happened to say, oh, I thought he was going too fast. This was very different. This witness was definitely an expert. He was presented as one. He was disclosed as one. And the rules say that if he's disclosed as an expert, then we have to get a complete statement of the opinions he's going to offer.
Mr. Murphy, I'll point out you have about a minute and 46 seconds left.
Then I just reserve the rest of that time, and the issue of negligence per se is no less important. However, I do believe it's fully briefed. So,
okay, thank you. Good morning.
May it please the court and counsel, and can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay, thank you. My name is Elizabeth Moran, registration number 16119 from Pryor Johnson Carney Carr Nixon. With me in the audience is my co-counsel, Valerie Garcia. We represent Jason Schaefer, who, as you know, was the driver of the semi-tractor trailer truck that ended up jackknifed across the highway. I won't go into the facts. They're set forth in the brief, so I'll go directly to the argument about Sergeant Gates' testimony. The entire basis of plaintiff's argument with respect to Dr. Gates is that his opinions were expert opinions that were not timely and adequately disclosed before his deposition. But Sergeant Gates was not giving expert testimony. He was not offered as an expert. He was not qualified by the court as an expert, either via his deposition or during the course of trial. In fact, plaintiff's counsel pointed out to the jury in his own closing argument that Sergeant Gates was not testifying as an expert. He was not doing accident reconstruction.
Counsel, excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I don't know if my microphone is working or not, but just to follow up on your point, I think when your colleague was examining Detective Gates, each of the key questions began with the words, based on your training, experience, you read such and what is your opinion about such and such? And those are words practically taken almost directly out of Rule 702, which is the rule on expert testimony. So in effect, wasn't counsel actually asking Mr. Gates or Sergeant Gates for an expert opinion?
Your Honor, that was actually a point that was addressed by a panel of this court in the People versus Russell case. It's not the form of the question put to the witness that determines what kind of testimony they are giving. It is the testimony itself. So even phrasing a question in terms of training or experience under Rule 702, that's the question, but it does not determine the nature of the answer. What this court needs to do is to look at the testimony that Sergeant Gates gave and ask two questions. First of all, were the matters he was testifying about matters that are within the knowledge and common experience of ordinary citizens? And second, were the conclusions and impressions he testified about the kinds of conclusions that ordinary people can reach through a process of everyday reasoning? All of the testimony that plaintiff complains of that Sergeant Gates gave, both of these questions, the answer is yes. People who drive, most of us drive, almost all of us drive, or at least we've ridden in a car. On a daily basis, as ordinary citizens, we make assessments about speed, distance, driving behavior. Are we going too fast? Is the other guy going too fast? Who's going too slow? Who's following too closely? Who's swerving? Those kinds of things. Similarly, ordinary people have experience with driving in weather, at least people who drive cars, and especially in Colorado, and know that, as a matter of their common experience, that weather affects the way you drive and can sometimes make accidents unavoidable, that you take special precautions during weather. You adjust your speed, you adjust your distance. In fact, by law in Colorado, every driver on the road has to know what a reasonable speed is for the conditions and a reasonable following distance. Those are the statutes that were actually talked about in another part of this appeal. As drivers, we are deemed to know what is reasonable. This is a matter of ordinary experience, and we draw these conclusions every day. This is what Sergeant Gates was doing. In fact, he was telling what he saw and his conclusions based on what he saw about speed, distance, and what impact the weather was having on what was happening. In fact, virtually every lay witness at trial who was involved in the accident gave this type of testimony. How fast they were going, how fast other drivers were going, the guy ahead, was he going too fast or too slow, how other drivers were behaving, and the weather, the effect of the weather, the precautions they had to take. They slowed down, they made more space, and when it got to the point where they had to stop, despite what they were trying to do, braking, maneuvering, they could not avoid the accident. The weather was the cause of the accident. This kind of testimony came in through countless witnesses at trial.
But pardon me, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't there a certain cachet if you, it's one thing if you have other drivers on the road, but if you have a state patrol officer whose job it is to be out on the road, isn't there a certain extra something to that person's testimony? In fact, that's why you wanted him to testify, right? Because he added some oomph to the argument that it was the conditions. And that oomph was based upon the fact not only does he have a respected job in society, but he is trained and he works with traffic problems all the time.
Your Honor, I can't say what the decision behind him testifying was since I wasn't trial counsel. He is a state patrolman, and state patrolmen have experience with accidents. But in several cases, this court has made the point that merely having more experience than ordinary people does not transfer lay testimony into expert testimony. For example, in one of the cases, and I can't remember the name of it offhand, but a certified addiction counselor gave testimony about whether a defendant appeared to be under the influence of methamphetamines. And the panel of this court held that that was a lay opinion. The fact that she had more experience than ordinary people in dealing with addicted people and observing them did not make her conclusions, which were based upon her face-to-face observations, expert opinions. They were the expressions of somebody witnessing something and describing it in the way that they perceived it. And that's a proper lay testimony. Similarly, there was a case, I believe it was the People versus Rincon case, where an officer testified about the difficulties people experience in identifying people in photo lineups. Again, the observation was made that this was a police officer who has a lot more experience than most people with a photo lineup, but that doesn't make his observations about common everyday occurrences using common reasoning, that doesn't make that expert testimony. It's still lay testimony.
So. Excuse me, Ms. Moran, let me ask you this, then, just so I understand your argument. And Sergeant Gates' testimony, when he's asked about what could have caused the tractor to start to slide, he says, I believe it could, the impact in the back of the trailer. I believe it could. I'm not an engineer, but based on experience, I believe it's possible that that type of rear-end collision potentially could cause a change in direction or a change in movement of another vehicle, even a vehicle the size of a semi. So you're saying that that's something that the normal, untrained, unexperienced motorist on the highway could express an opinion about?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is something that a driver who is driven on ice and knowing the fine line between holding your place on ice and having something come into contact with you that can throw that off, especially something as large as a semi, which we know fishtails and jackknives because it's an articulated truck. That is something that is within common experience, and it's within the experience of a police officer who has experience dealing with these things. But again, it's not expert testimony because ordinary people can figure this out with everyday reasoning. In, I believe it's the People versus McMinn case, there was a similar issue about an officer. There was an incident in which a perpetrator was driving a car toward an officer at a certain rate of speed that could have hurt him. I don't believe it did, but there was an assault charge and there was a reconstruction. The officer involved testified about what he saw, and then another officer who reconstructed came in and talked about the force that could a car be a deadly weapon traveling at 20 miles per hour if it struck a pedestrian. And the court noted that while that kind of towed the line as to whether it was expert testimony, the proposition that a car going at 20 miles an hour could really hurt a person was something that we all understand and ordinary people can figure out. Same thing here, a truck on an icy highway being touched twice by whatever is behind it when it's already trying to react to the straight truck fishtailing ahead of it, that it's common understanding that can tip the balance and lead to, ultimately a disaster here. I would like to point out that the plaintiff had an adequate opportunity through its own expert, Mr. Railsback, to counter virtually everything that Sergeant Gates said. Mr. Railsback came into court and said, with respect to Mr. Schaefer particularly, and he's the only defendant left in the case, that Mr. Schaefer was driving unreasonably, that he was following too close, that had he been doing things right and adhering to the distances and speeds he should have, that despite this weather, he should have been able to stop and control his vehicle. That was a counter to Sergeant Gates' testimony. Sergeant Gates was, in fact, cross-examined by a plaintiff during the deposition about his ability to see the effect of the poor visibility conditions, the fact that he was not there to observe and document everything that happened, but he was there trying to keep things from getting worse and running around and trying to protect people from being injured and not trying to figure out who's going how fast and how far apart. Plaintiffs had an adequate opportunity to counter that. They could have called Mr. Rails back as a rebuttal witness. No rebuttal witnesses were called. They have not identified anything that could have been produced through any other witness, expert or lay, that, you know, had they had more time after his deposition, they could have come up with something different to offer. They offered what they had, and the jury made their decision. I don't think the plaintiff has demonstrated an abuse of discretion by the trial courts in admitting the lay testimony of Sergeant Gates, and I would ask the court to affirm that decision. I'd like to move briefly on to the negligence per se instructions, and again, point out that the court did not abuse its discretion in denying specific instructions on negligence per se. There's two reasons for this. First reason is that the instructions that the plaintiffs tendered had the whole statutes, both statutes on speed and following distance, 90% of which was totally irrelevant to this case and would have hopelessly confused the jury. It's not the trial court's job to draft the instructions, it's counsel's job. That's certainly a basis the court could have excluded the instructions. And as this court knows, it can affirm the court on any basis supported by the record. But second and most importantly is that, in essence, the negligence per se instructions were no different from the concepts covered by the common law negligence instructions in this case. The statutes set forth a standard of conduct that is basically reasonable and prudent speed under the circumstances, reasonable and prudent following distance under the circumstances. Here, under the negligence theory, plaintiff received five instructions on negligence. The first one, the general instruction, is negligence is doing an act a reasonably careful person would not do, or failing to do an act that a reasonably careful person would do under the same or similar circumstances. The jury received an instruction on what is reasonable care. It's what a reasonably careful person would do. They received a specific instruction about vehicle speed. A driver has a duty not to go at a speed greater than is reasonable under the circumstances. A lookout instruction. A driver has a duty to keep a reasonable lookout to see what a reasonably careful person would see. And then finally, if you rear-end a vehicle in the back, you're presumed negligence. So all of these instructions incorporated the same concept, the same standard of conduct as the negligence per se instructions plaintiff was tendering, and that's reasonable and prudent care under the circumstances. When the standard is the same between common law negligence and statutory negligence or negligence per se, you don't need separate instructions for both. Basically, the jury has to find the defendant negligent in order to find them negligent under the statute. Here, the jury found Mr. Schaefer was not negligent. It didn't find that he had acted unreasonably. It didn't find that he wasn't careful. If they didn't find negligence, they could not have found negligence per se under the statutes that plaintiff tendered. Therefore, there's no impact on the outcome, and it cannot be reversible error. I see I'm ticking down to the final 20 seconds. I'd ask the court if it has any further questions. Yes, Your Honor.
Just going back to your first issue, this deposition was a preservation issue asked for by your client, correct?
I believe so, Your Honor.
I mean, that's in the trial management order, and that's how Ms. Garcia started the deposition. So this was, in effect, the trial testimony. This was the trial testimony of Sergeant Gates, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there was no other option, there was no opportunity for counsel to cross-examine him again. That was the last chance, right?
It was at that stage in the proceedings. I think as the panel questioned, there could have been a continuance requested, and it could have been redone and the issue revisited. A continuance was not requested. No additional relief was requested by the plaintiff.
But in the absence of a continuance, there is no way of doing that, correct? He wasn't available to attend the trial. That was the representation.
That's correct.
In his testimony.
That's correct. He yeah. was not. He could okay. not be present at trial.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Murphy, you have a minute and 43 seconds left.
I'll try and make the most of it, Your Honor. Thank you. Please, the court. The court, one of the judges pointed out exactly what I would have about the testimony of Sergeant Gates about the collision with the semi, whether that could push it. I think that's the easiest one to see is far beyond the scope of a normal driver. What a tractor trailer will do when it's hit is not in the common experience. I've seen videos where they run over a car and keep going straight and then move out of their lane. So I think it's disingenuous to say that any juror would know that if it got hit in the back at a very low rate of speed, by the way, that it could have caused it to jackknife. So I think that's the clearest example of it not being lay opinion, although I think they're all expert opinions.
Let me ask you a question and get to the quick of the jury instructions. What would the negligence per se instruction that you proffered have added to the set of instructions that were actually given to the jury?
So there was no instruction given that would inform the jury that following too close was negligent or that driving at an unreasonable speed for the conditions was negligent. And that the standard for determining what is negligence is not just what a reasonable driver would do, but these very specific statutes. And as far as the statutes being long, the second one is long. The first one is four paragraphs, and they're very, very short and very, very succinct. So I don't think it was confusing. It would have been confusing to the jury. And in fact, I think the completeness of the statute is, in those cases, a better way to go because there could be multiple violations. And in fact, under one of the statutes, there were. I would also say that under Hagman v. TSI, Inc., that's at 789P2D1452, and it's in the brief, but not for this proposition, the court specifically found that it was error to not give the negligence per se instruction when there was evidence to support that. Now, I have to say, in any driving case, and Hagman was, that following the statutes is part of reasonable behavior, and therefore, if you're going to say, telling them about negligence is enough, and you don't have to also tell them about negligence per se in a case where you bring negligence per se claims, then there is no negligence per se in traffic law. And I don't think that's the state of the law. In fact, the panel of this court found that it was error not to give the instruction when there was evidence in the record to support it. And that's what it adds. It adds the specific, hey, if you violate these statutes, that is negligence, whether you think it was reasonable or not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you both for your excellent arguments today. Those arguments will be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision in this case. The matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much, and the court is going to take